In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, movie troopers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm Ella Kemp.
And I'm Meg Walters.
On the show this week, it's Palme d'Or winner Anatomy of a Fall, and I spoke to its star and probably my favourite actor on the planet, Sandra Hüller. Things go terribly wrong in the Australian outback in the Royal Hotel, and I also had the pleasure of talking to its director, Kitty Green. And finally, we review a third new release, the evocatively titled How to Have Sex. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, welcome back to you both. It's been a little while. Should we do a little reintro? Meg, you want to go first? Who are you and what have you been up to?
Hi, I'm Meg. I'm a freelance writer. I mostly write about film and TV, but I do write about also everything else under the sun. These days, I'm writing a lot of stylist and glamour, which has been really fun, doing some like film, TV, and also lifestyle stuff for them. I have a piece coming out in Little White Lies today, I think, day of recording, which is exciting. And yeah, I don't know, that's what I do. And I'm a Canadian who lives in London.
What's the piece in Little White Lies about?
It's about girlhood in films this year. So it's like quite a big sweeping look at a lot of the, there's a lot of films this year that focus on like that time in your life, whether it's when you're a teenager or you're a young woman and you're like on the verge of entering womanhood. And yeah, I looked at all of those films kind of in the context of culture today. I think there's like some really interesting things going on with the way we think about girls in society today. Mm-hmm. There's like the TikTok girl trends that are endless and are never going to end apparently. And there's also like on the political, social side, there's like a lot of quite dark stuff going on. So that's in a nutshell what the piece is on.
That sounds incredible. And kind of in the intersection of that is that whole girl dinner thing. And I read a really interesting piece about how like girl dinner is actually like a feminist act.
Yeah, well, I think there's like a part of, you can look at it in the sense that it's often women who are hopping aboard these trends. You know, it's not like always teenage girls, it's millennials or even like Gen X women who are looking back on their own experience of girlhood and maybe like reclaiming, finding some like joy in it when there are obviously like quite awful sides to being a girl as well.
There are indeed. Yes, wouldn't go back there for all the money in the world. What about you? What have you been up to?
I think since the last time I was on the podcast, I have been to approximately, if my girl math is correct, I've been to maybe 500 film festivals in that time, or at least it feels that way, which has been good. It's been fun. I went to Cannes, went to Toronto, Locarno, which I will somehow get to talk about later, Edinburgh, all sorts of things, and London. And for the last month, like everyone else I know, I've had a cold for the last month. But work-wise, I have a new job title since last pod, I think. I'm now the London editor at Letterboxd, which is fun, doing all the same things as before. So interviewing folks, or meeting people in person, putting on screenings, asking people their four favourites, writing stories and posting silly tweets or whatever they're called now, but I'm calling them tweets. And I still run the editorial platform for Girls on Tops, where we champion women in film. So it's quite the week this week. We're having fun.
Well, congratulations on the new year and congratulations on Martin Scorsese joining Letterboxd.
Yeah, thank you so much. Funnily enough, so one of the filmmakers that we're talking about today Molly Manning Walker, who directed How to Have Sex. I had the privilege of hosting a Q&A with her earlier this week. And the first thing she said to me, we've met before, but the first thing she said to me was like, I think you need a raise. And I was like, what are you talking about? She says, you got Martin Scorsese on Letterboxd. And I said, I wish I had anything to do with it. But yes, my personal direct line to Martin Scorsese, I just texted him. And yeah, he made an account. That's definitely what happened. Fun though.
Yeah, we should get a move on. We've got three very exciting films from three incredible female directors. And we are three women as well. So a real kind of ovary fest over here. First one up is going to be Palme d'Or winner Anatomy of a Fall.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
For the past year, Sandra and her husband Samuel and their 11-year-old son Daniel have lived a secluded life in a remote town in the French Alps. When Samuel is found dead in the snow below their chalet, the police question whether he was murdered or committed suicide. Samuel's suspicious death is presumed murder, and Sandra becomes the main suspect. But before we get into the film, here's the conversation I had with its star, Sandra Hüller.
Sandra, this is so exciting for me. I cannot tell you what a huge fan of yours I am.
Thank you, Lena.
I genuinely feel that Tony Erdmann changed the whole way I view the world, so this is thrilling.
Thank you. Yeah, cool.
But just this year alone, you've got these three incredibly well-received projects, you know, with Sissy and I at the Zone of Interest, Anatomy of a Fall. What is your process to choose what it is that you're going to work on?
It's a very intuitive process that I can't really explain. Mm-hmm. There are always different reasons why I do something. Sometimes it's the character, sometimes it's the director that I've known for a long time and we want to spend time together again. It's sometimes really simple. Sometimes it's something that I'm really afraid of and I don't know if I'm capable of doing it and I want to find out. Sometimes it's a place I want to be. Sometimes it's an energy that I want to be close to, or a question that I want to ask or have answered, or it's always very, very, very different reasons. And the reason that these projects are so close is just because of COVID. They would never have started in this row. It would never have happened that way. So I thank COVID.
Yeah, had to be a silver lining, I suppose. But you also now, you know, not just with like three big films in a single year, but all these accolades that are coming out for each one. You know, does that mean a lot to you? I imagine something like the Palme d'Or is like a huge moment, but like all of them are getting like huge amounts of attention.
Both films were so successful, it can definitely, yeah, of course it means something, but I always think, yeah, I cannot take it to my grave, so it's also, it's important, and at the same time, it's not at all. Everybody in the team really enjoyed the time that we had in Cannes, and the premieres and the screenings and the conversations that we had about it, the love of the audience that we felt really strongly, yeah, so that there were so many beautiful, how do you say, encounters, meeting people that were really touched. And yeah, that's very important.
Have you always been able to just follow your intuition when it comes to selecting projects? Or is it something that like maybe after like a Tony Erdmann, you know, you just get enough kind of being offered to you where you can become very selective?
Is it the opposite? I mean, that's an ideal situation to always follow your intuition. And I was always able to select a little bit. Yeah, I think I strongly believe in having a choice. So yeah, in the beginning after Tony, there were lots of scripts with people in corporate things, like in offices and people in situations of power, or, you know. So I kind of felt I kind of did that. I don't want to explore it any longer. I want to do something else. And it took some time until I found out what I wanted to do. And so, yeah.
You're kind of working with these acclaimed auteurs, but does the sort of lure of like the Hollywood block blockbuster appeal to you at all, going and doing a big 2.5 hour green screen superhero, you know, anything like that?
Somebody asked me that today before, and I asked him back why he wants to know, because it's such a, I don't understand the question, but now I do. And I think it's not something that I would exclude, but it's not a fantasy of mine. Mm-hmm. I love doing sports and I wouldn't mind training like a few months to become a, I don't know, whatever fighting person and whatever, but I don't know. I can't say it from that point.
Well, I mean, just this year alone, I'm very glad you've made the choices that you have. It's been very enriching. But like in this film in particular, just to kind of focus a bit more on Anatomy of a Fall, you're speaking in three different languages. And like, what was the experience of like acting across these different ones where there's misinterpretations, but also you're not in your mother tongue?
I found it really enriching. I found it very interesting for perspective. I found it interesting as an actress, of course, because exploring how it feels to play in different languages, of course, is, yeah, it always gives me something, and it makes it easy to show so many different sides or so many different like perspectives on the character. And to see someone struggle with this, with a thing like language, is something so, so profound, something that so many people can relate with, mm-hmm. with the fear of not being understood, especially in such a situation. That's also something not everybody can relate to, but that we want to make ourselves be heard and to be, yeah, understood, and to struggle to find the words for it in a language, which is really humbling also. And I love this experience, and I love languages, and so yeah, I hope I can do it again sometime.
I mean, are there any kind of distinct challenges between like performing in English versus performing in French as a second language?
I was more familiar with English. I'm not perfect in it. I'm always looking for words and I make mistakes, but I grew up with MTV and I always watched, you know, all these shows, and I was learning song lyrics by heart, and I was always interested in that language, and French came much later. I had it in school and then it came back to me, I think, I don't know, 4 years ago or something, I decided to learn it again. And after that, like the whole French movie film thing started, but it's not so easy for me, and I'm still not fluent.
But working with a French director, were there any kind of like miscommunications because of like the way that you kind of had the language?
No, there weren't. Miraculously, no. There were two languages on set. Everybody was switching all the time between French and English. And I understand French pretty well now, mm-hmm. but sometimes I can't like finish a sentence because one word is missing, or because I don't want to make a mistake, but I understood what she was saying all the time. And I think our form of communication is anyway, like sort of all over the place with everything we got, you know? So it's, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
I mean, I've read interviews with the two of you kind of talking about this collaboration, and it seems to be quite like a profound connection that the two of you have. I mean, what was it that maybe, I guess it kind of formed on the set of Sybil, that kind of made you two connect?
Well, I saw a short film of Justine in 2011 or 12, I can't remember exactly, at the Berlinale. And I started to be a fan of her work at that moment, so I've been following her for quite some time. And so I kind of had an idea what she would be interested in anyway. And I don't know, sometimes these things happen, that people meet and they understand each other in a magical way. I don't know why it is. We have the same age. I don't know what it is, but it's really beautiful and I'm thankful for it.
Yeah, it's such a complicated character. It does feel that like you guys would have to be on such a kind of same page in order for this to like cohere. Do you think you understood the character in the same way from the beginning?
I'm not sure about that, mm-hmm. really, because Justine from the beginning had more information than I had. And also she knew much more about the judicial system in France. She really studied it, and she of course had like, I don't know how many versions of the script. There were so many decisions that she had already made, and then undone. And so she knew much more about the character than I did. But I like this sort of mystery also. And I'm not the person who wants to solve everything in a character or know everything in a character, because I strongly believe that we can't do that in human beings as well. So it's kind of a grandeur of fantasy of somebody, of an actor, to say, I really know my character inside mm-hmm. out. I don't believe that. Never happens. It can only make it smaller, in my opinion. But we tried a lot of things on set. So there were always different possibilities and what light she would appear, if that would be a scene where we would be with her or where we would turn against her. It's just small adjustments. Yeah, if somebody's really aggressive in a scene, or if they're really quiet, or if they're getting emotional. And so we tried all of that in different moments, so that Justine would have the possibility to decide in the editing which way she wanted to go with her.
Yeah, it walks such a beautifully fine line of ambiguity that you can almost picture the like worst version of this film when you're watching it. You're just like, oh, a lesser director would have done like easy answers, like, you know, a big twist.
Yeah, maybe there will be. Sometimes they do this sort of adaptations, I don't know. But yeah, I know what you mean. But I think that Justine consciously avoided this sort of choice. And it doesn't mean that American court dramas are bad or something. It's just not what she wanted. She wanted to show the French system, and she wanted to show the flaws and all the things that don't work. And that's something that I'm really familiar with, that I love to show too, in humans and everything. So
it does also feel that like this sort of plot could have like one big, you know, melodramatic moment monologue for you. And instead it's much more kind of consistently intriguing. But was there still like a scene that you came into it having read the script, getting ready to shoot, that you were particularly excited to shoot?
No, I feel the crying in the car is sort of a monologue.
Well, I mean, you know, crying is cathartic, I suppose, for both the person and the audience.
Yeah, maybe. Sometimes it's used to show that a woman that is not really likable has feelings too. I hate that when I see that in films. Oh, she has feelings. Oh, I didn't know. It's kind of a thing that you have to do to finally get the hearts of the audience. And it wasn't that way. I strongly felt that Justine didn't do it because of that. It was written as a panic attack, and there are a million sorts of panic attacks, and she had this sort of panic attack. It was not written as she bursts out crying, which is always very suspicious when I read it. And I was like, hey, what? Why? I decide when I cry. It's not something that's supposed to be written in a, you know. Yeah, but she didn't use it for anything. That's what I liked about it. And no, there wasn't a particular scene that I was looking forward to it. I loved everything about it.
Well, I mean, that whole idea of like having to make female characters likable, like, do you think that's still something that is like made, you know, when we have female protagonists, there is like that pressure that we have to make them sort of softer in a way that we don't necessarily with the male ones?
Yeah, I only feel it when you don't do it. Then you feel that something is different than before. When you consciously decide against it, it is a change. I recently saw this documentary about male gaze in films, Brainwashed, is it called?
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. There's some things that I could argue about, but I didn't know about those techniques. I didn't know about the long, long, long tradition of showing women in film in a certain way as an object. And of course, Justine doesn't do it. I just recently found out, I mean, I've been doing it and the camera was in front of me, but we only see her from, most of the time she's filmed from underneath. Mostly women are filmed from above. So she's bigger than us. And of course I was sitting a bit high, but still it's something very unusual to see. And I was very happy that I discovered that she made that choice. Yeah, to not go into that trap of, we have to believe her because, I don't know, you have to do that to make people believe that you're a good person or that you're not guilty or whatever. She never did this kind of thing.
I mean, guilt is such a strong
theme throughout the film, because it's, you know, whether or not she's done the thing that she's accused of, there's this idea that she should still feel guilt because she's failed as a partner, regardless of what the outcome was. I mean, do you think that's kind of part of her being a woman? Like, you know, that that is gendered in the way that we kind of view female characters as still being responsible for the outcomes of what happens to the men around them?
Yes. It's kind of a, it's told to be a genetic code that we are, you know, it's like the basics that we're talking about, and we're caring and that we can forgive more easily and all that stuff. But all that is so exhausting. It's just something that is not something that you just do. It's also a conscious decision to do that because you feel the world would be better if there would be one more person. My English is not enough to, if you would forgive one more person, you know, but it's not something that you wake up and you just do. But I think men can do this, can make the same effort. There was this essay recently, was it The New Yorker? Why women forgive and men are forgiven?
I haven't read it, but that sounds about right.
Yeah, and I found that really interesting. And it says that it's not something that, that forgiveness is not something that, but it's off topic now. It's not something that we should assume is always the right thing to do. There are things that are unforgivable, and it's okay to live without forgiving someone. It's totally fine. And I have to think about it because it's like a really different impulse, but I would always try to, you know, to make peace with people. But for her, for Sandra, she should still feel guilty because she failed as a partner. I mean, he failed as a partner too, and he just went away. I mean, what is that? I never saw it that way, really. I just felt that, of course, the verdict doesn't tell us if she really did it or not. It just tells it in front of the law, that people can still make their assumptions and have their fantasies about her and judge her for as long as whatever, as long as they want.
I mean, there is that very, very insidious thing of the way that, like, women are portrayed in the media, particularly when it comes to crime, violence, that it's almost like it's a bit sexy, it's a bit salacious and stuff, and we stop to see the human. I mean, was part of the appeal of this that you were actually coming back to a very human story at the core of it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think that, I think it tells us something about, first of all, we don't know everything about our partner. And second of all, it's always just a little glimpse we get once we look into a relationship. You can never see the full story. And it asks the question if it's right to put it in public in the first place. This sort of case, is it something that people should see? Or the child should be present at? Or, you know, all these things. Is it right that a person, and I wouldn't gender that, a person that has experienced this sort of horror in their life needs to defend her lifestyle in front of court? Is something that is, to me, it's unthinkable. And yet it happens all the time because people include all sorts of information into their judgment. And where is the border of law, or what is necessary to find out if somebody did something or not?
The idea of justice is very interesting in this film, the way it's kind of perceived as not sort of being separate to the events themselves. I mean, finding out about how the French legal system worked and how this sort of person would be treated, did it change your perspective on that at all?
Well, the German judicial system is still different from that. So it's kind of a, I didn't think about it any longer because I don't live in France. So it was kind of, you know, not really my business. Mm. But what I did think about, and also that has to do with the reactions of the audience, especially women, that tell all sorts of stories in the after they saw the film, personal stories. Some say it's my life that I see here. I have to deal with the same conflict and it's unsolvable. And others say to me that they feel like she's a bad mother, or how I feel about her treating her son that way. And I don't understand what they mean because I find she's really respectful with him. So there are all sorts of projections going on. Yeah, that's more of the thing that I'm dealing with, that I get. Like the there is also judgment going on about certain details, and the reflection that we wanted to have, that we wanted people to have on their own behavior and on their own judgment towards other people, sometimes doesn't even happen. It's rare, but sometimes, yeah, people just don't put it into, like when they judge her, they don't put it into, like they don't do what we wanted them to do. Let's say it like that.
God, that's really devastating to me to hear that people came away from that film and judged her as a mother. But, oh, my goodness. Okay, that's what I'll be thinking about the rest of the day. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I so admire your work, and it's been so enriching to me. And, like, yeah, just thank you so much for your time. And
very, very good and interesting questions. And thank you very much. Yeah.
Ella, like part of the 500 festivals that you went to this year, you'd mentioned Cannes was one of them, and this was the big winner there. Do you think kind of worthy of that prize?
Yes and no. I didn't see the film in Cannes, actually. It was one of the only ones that, like the big ones that people were talking about, that I missed, because I had to take the day off to interview Wes Anderson, which I'm not complaining about. At the time I knew that everyone was talking about it, and you know, I like Justine Triet a lot. I think she's a really cool filmmaker. Same with Sandra Hüller. I caught up with the film in August, and I think it's good. I personally would have given the palm, and I still stand by this, to Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest, which won the jury prize, if I'm not mistaken.
Which also has Sandra Hüller in it.
Of the two Sandra Hüller films, that's the one that I would have gone for personally, but I don't make the rules. I think it's very good. I'm happy that that a woman won the Palme d'Or again. That's cool. And I think the film is solid. Like, I am a bit surprised, in the sense that I think when I watched it, underwhelmed is the wrong word, but I think it's quite, like, it's a very subtle film, I think. It's not as explosive, as in your face, as some other Palme d'Or winners that I would have expected, which is funny because I just thought of Corrie's Shoplifters as I said that, which is not explosive in any way. However, I was a bit surprised that it won. I'm happy for what it means, but for me, in competition at Cannes this year, there were other titles that, I don't know, I thought just kind of blew everything out the water. Good film, though, as everyone agrees on.
Well, so long as Sandra Hüller is in the winning film, I'm all happy. I've been obsessed with her since Tony Erdmann. And yeah, she never lets me down. What about you, Meg? What did you make of Anatomy of a Fall? I mean, it's an unusual one, but I absolutely loved it.
I really liked it. Yeah, I actually saw this for the first time last night on my TV. So yeah, I missed it. I was only at London Film Festival this year, and I haven't had a chance to see it yet until last night. And yeah, I really, really liked it. It is definitely super subtle, but I think it's just such an interesting dive into the thorniness of like a relationship, and of how the truth can get so tangled as soon as you start, you know, looking at people's subjective perceptions of their relationships with other people and trying to put together some kind of like objectifiable truth on that. Like, I think it immediately made me think of, have you guys seen The Staircase, the document, yes, the Netflix documentary? I mean, it's such a similar story, in that like one half of a couple falls seemingly, and the other one either did it or like doesn't know what happened. And then like the blood spatter analysis and like all of these like really detailed investigations that seem to almost bring you further from the truth and closer to it somehow. And I just love how like you think you've gotten sort of to the middle of how tangled this web is, but you just like, it keeps digging you further and further in.
I think future historians will study the true crime brain phenomenon, where like there's sort of, it almost, I think it's happened to the culture, but I also feel like it's happening within like the justice system, of like we expect kind of neat solutions and kind of like gotcha moments where it all unlocks. And this just seemed to be like the most wonderful counterpoint to that. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think that feeds into a little bit why I was underwhelmed. I think it's because there had been so much hype, which we've discussed many times on this podcast and in other places, but I think when there is so much hype from a festival or any other sort of preview setting, I expected like a big, like, oh shit moment, and this film doesn't quite give you that, and it's good, you know. Like, I'm looking forward to rewatching it because I think obviously it's so rich and it's very, very complex, and I think when you go into a film expecting something, either because, you know, this isn't based on a book, but if you read the book, you think, oh, okay, I'm waiting for that story beat to drop. Or if you've heard something that happens, however good the film is, if you're waiting for one specific thing to happen and it doesn't happen, you will always be disappointed, which reflects more on you / me, the viewer, I think. But yeah, that was definitely a case with Anatomy of a Fall. But I will say, so where I did end up seeing the film was at the Locarno Film Festival, and it played in the Piazza Grande, which is basically this beautiful square in Locarno, which is like a stunning little town in Switzerland. Yeah, Piazza Grande is like a lovely little square, but basically it turns into this massive outdoor cinema during the festival. And the size of the screen is, I don't know the dimensions, but it felt bigger than literally any screen I've been in London, except IMAX maybe. But and also the sound system is incredible because they've literally got complete surround sound. But it's insane to say that because the surround sound is like speakers attached to buildings that people just like live in, and restaurants and stuff like that in this, you know, rural picturesque town. And yeah, it's 8,000 seats. So yeah, we were there. But the amazing thing is that everyone in the square, you know, the very functioning touristy popular square with restaurants and everything, when a film is on, everyone respects it. So all of the restaurants basically just go silent. And, you know, like in parts where when that one needle drop is not playing in Anatomy of a Fall, it's quite a quiet film. Like there are lots of moments of, you know, and it was complete silence in that square, which is crazy considering the number of people in the audience, but also people who are just coming and going because it's a public square. So I think like that was both a testament to, you know, what Locarno have set up with that square, and also just how much Anatomy of a Fall like really keeps you like gripped and in, even if it is a bit more subtle in that way. So yeah, it was very like, I felt very lucky to kind of watch the film in that way for sure.
Yeah, when you first started, I was like, I can't think of a worse way to watch this film.
No, I know. Well, honestly, when I saw it listed...
No, that sounds great.
Yeah, the when I saw it listed at the festival, I thought, I was like, oh, you know, I haven't seen it, so I want to watch it here. But I generally don't love outdoor cinemas. But it was honestly, like, it was one of the best, you know, viewing both sound and vision experiences I've had, indoors or outdoors. Like, it was all just, I don't know how they do it, honestly. So yeah, big recommend to that screen.
Right, well, we'll be pitching a Live from Locarno podcast for next year.
You have to.
Because that sounds wonderful. Like, mate, this quite... there is something that I've found interesting in this of, like, you know, we have to talk about female characters get kind of passed through this idea of, like, likability and stuff, and that is also the case in life, not just in, like, cinema and stuff. And, like, you know, obviously she's not the sort of likable damsel that I suppose perhaps, like, the justice system and the society in generally treats well. I mean, like, how did you read her character?
I think, yeah, that's a really interesting point, because what really, like, struck me was, like, the prosecution lawyer's whole tack was kind of proving her to be this, like, controlling, domineering woman who had somehow, like, usurped her husband's position in the family, you know, like, he should be the one in control, but now she's the one, you know. So I just thought that was a really interesting kind of subtle look at, like, that brand of sexism that can happen where women are judged for being too masculine or too, yeah, not what, like, wife-like enough. And yeah, there's stuff, she's not a perfect person or like a nice person even a lot of the time. And I think the film is all the more stronger for it.
Yeah, it's
interesting when it becomes like the crux of the case, because, you know, it almost becomes like a trial of her personality and her, like, femininity almost.
Yeah, and the idea of kind of like her success is almost like an act of aggression.
Yeah, I mean, relationships are always so complicated, and like knowing how to split time, especially when both people are working, or and like creative people as well. But that idea that, like, that she owes him time as his wife to do more around the house or to do this or that, and she says, you know, I do things. But yeah.
Yeah, God. It's not a great week if you kind of want to feel terribly positive about what the men are up to. Ella, like, without spoiling it, what did you make of the ending?
I think it's an ending that plays better with every minute that you think about it. I think it had to grow on me, for sure. Because like, Justine Triet is so good at building up tension throughout in, you know, very sort of complex ways that she's, like, I felt a bit hoodwinked. I felt like it was really leading towards something and then something else happened. But then the more I kind of sat with it and was talking about it, I think it's such a good film to talk about. Well, you know, when people have seen it and you don't want to spoil it. But I think it's such a good film to talk about and sort of debate over. I do think that, like, one of my favorite quotes about, like, film criticism and discussion and debate and anything is always when a piece of art or anything can make you say, this is where the conversation starts, not where it ends. And I feel like the ending of this film really, really does that, where I feel like Justin Trier is kind of going like, okay, I've said my bit, now your turn, which I think is quite a power move. I like it. I do think that the winner of the film, and this isn't a spoiler in any way, the winner of the film is 100% Snoop the dog, who comes off amazingly. Well, this was another thing about not seeing the film in Cannes. So in Cannes every year, there is a ceremony called the Palme d'Or, which you would be surprised if you've never heard of it, how deadly serious people, like, this isn't a joke. I'm not, you know, and it was the best dog performances of the festival, and there's always many contenders. Like, there's never sort of lacking, you know, any pups for the Palme d'Or. And the dog whose name I can't remember, Messi the dog, who plays Snoop the dog in Anatomy of a Fall 1. And at the time I was like, oh, cool. Like, you know, Messi looks like a very handsome dog. And then you watch the film and it's like, oh my God, you're doing everything. And it's so cool. Like, it's, you know, because it is, I do genuinely believe, jokes aside, that it is one thing to have like a pet in the film who, you know, it's nice to see them because it makes you feel better because they're just cute. But then to actually have a pet that is driving the narrative forward and doing stuff is so cool. And I know I'm saying all this while smiling, but like, it's not funny. Messi and Snoop are just so good. So that was my big takeaway, I think.
Yeah, I mean, hard to kind of hold your own against Sandra Huller on screen. But yeah, he did some scene stealing. But yeah, we've got two more kind of What's Wrong With The Men movies to get onto. Ella, do you want to get some scores on this one? In Anticipation, Enjoyment, and In Retrospect.
So I'm going to go... I think I'm going to go 4-3-4. Expectations were quite high. I hadn't seen any of Justine Triet's previous films, so I didn't fully know what to expect, but heard a lot of good things. 3, purely because I think I had sort of put expectations on the film that the film never asked me to. So I was expecting something that it wasn't. And then 4, because it's great. And I realised that I'm the problem. And it's a very good film.
In the words of our feminist leader, Taylor Swift, we're the problem. It's us to be.
Hi.
To paraphrase. Meg, what about you?
I think I'll go like a solid 4-4. I was really excited to see it. I mean, I haven't had much time to like reflect on it as I watched it about 12 hours ago. But having spoken about it today, I do think my opinions about it are holding. I thought it was, yeah, really good. It surprised me too. I think maybe because I wasn't really expecting like a gotcha moment, I was like quite happy while watching it to sit with like the uncertainty of everything.
I actually think rather depressingly, all of my scores today are going to be about the same. So 4-4-4. I like movies. I thought this was really a great film. My criteria for giving anything a 5 is that it kind of in some way changes my life, and I don't think it quite got there, but I was very happy that this subtle, complex work is getting the great honours that it does, and, you know, Sandra Huller deserves to be in every Palme d'Or winner every year, so, like, yeah, let's keep that pattern going, even if maybe, like you, Ella, I did slightly prefer the Jonathan Glazer, but never mind.
Hopefully Messi makes it into the next Palme d'Or winner as well.
Oh, yes. What a reunion that would be. Next up, it's the Royal Hotel.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Canadians Hannah and Liv are best friends backpacking in Australia. After they run out of money, Liv, looking for an adventure, convinces Hannah to take a temporary live-in job at the Royal Hotel, a pub in a remote outback mining town. But soon, Hannah and Liv find themselves trapped in an unnerving situation that grows rapidly out of control. Before we get into the film, here's my conversation with director Kitty Green.
I mean, what's it been like doing the press for this? Because, I mean, it's quite nice that in some way, just behind you, there is a photograph of Julia and Jessica. But, yeah, it must be strange doing it all alone.
Yeah, I guess. Weirdly, I mean, the assistant had its own trouble with being the pandemic and things like that, so it was hard to kind of do press then too. So this is, I'm just used to there's always something that goes wrong whenever I release a movie, I guess. So, yeah, it's fine. I'm kind of used to it. I just don't like the camera stuff, and the, you know, but the rest is fine.
Oh, being on the other side of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that's not why I got into this business.
But am I right in thinking that the film has some basis in the documentary Hotel Coolgardie, is it? I mean, how did you first come to that documentary?
I was on a film festival jury and I had to watch maybe 10 Australian docs as part of that, and it was sort of like the seventh one and I was like kind of, you know, when you're sort of falling asleep and you take notice, and it was really something different. I just hadn't seen Australia represented that way through that lens, I guess, which is young women but also foreign women in kind of trying to figure the culture out in their own way and standing up to it and saying no and telling people that when they disagreed with certain things. I thought all that was kind of interesting, and like maybe coming off the back of The Assistant, which was sort of about an acceptance of a system being rotten. It was like interesting to me to explore something where there's actually women going, hang on, I don't know if I'm ready to put up with this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess some of the comparisons I've seen have been like Wake and Fright, of like the idea of like the outback being a place where it's like you look into the eyes of it and it kind of turns, the abyss turns on you and you become monstrous as well. Mm-hmm. Do you have any like inspirations in terms of like outback movies?
Not really. I mean, it's hard because a lot of those movies where you see young women in the outback, they're murdered or attacked or assaulted, and we were trying to, I guess, challenge all that. So we took a lot of the setup and we took a lot of the premise, and we're kind of definitely nodding at the genre, sort of horror or whatever it is, early on. But then we're sort of trying to push against it and make our own film about the things that we think. Well, the things that we want to explore, which is to do with this kind of bad behaviour that doesn't necessarily cross the line but dances on that line, essentially, the whole time.
I mean, it doesn't feel like it's just a portrait of this specific place. There's a sort of ambiguous, alluded to bad thing that happened in Canada that in some ways they're fleeing from. Was there a reason that you kept what that was, ambiguous?
first, like, here's the thing. If they'd come from a background, like Thelma and Louise, there's been a previous sort of attack or assault or whatever happened mm-hmm. there. And they're kind of coming, and it's sort of, people can kind of excuse their behaviors like a revenge for that. And what we wanted was a set of women who were just saying no. You know, it didn't matter what had happened in their past. It didn't matter where they'd come from. This behavior's not okay, and we shouldn't have to put up with it. You know, so that to me was really important, that was what they were just dealing with, what was in front of them, versus some past trauma that's feeding into the way they're acting or behaving. So I wanted to touch on something. I wanted a reason for Jess's character to be drinking that much. I felt like she needed to kind of have a story she wanted to get out of her, but I didn't feel like it was necessary to really dive into the details. Both her and I sort of discussed about how we'd pull it together and what that was, but yeah, that was sort of the way. I didn't think more backstory was going to do much in terms of, you know, elevating the craft or whatever.
No, I mean, I love the movie, so, like...
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
The dynamic between them, like, they're very convincing as, like, best friends that would do anything for one another, but very different young women. I mean, like, how did you view the relationship between them?
I don't know. So whenever I've travelled or backpacked with a friend, there's always somebody that has to, like, look at Google Maps and, like, figure out when you check in and figure out when you check out and, like, deal with the stuff. And the other person can relax a little and enjoy a little and drink a little. And I feel like it felt like that felt very natural to me, that the kind of duo would split that way. But there's also something about making an Australian movie where I think Jess's character is a little more Australian in her attitude and a little more accepting of the culture and accepting of, and really trying to give it a go, which mm-hmm. is sort of what, as Australians, we encourage people to do. And Julia's saying no, and I think that kind of, the kind of resistance is interesting to me, and it plays quite differently in the States or in Australia, and I'm still figuring out how it's playing here, but the dynamic sort of works differently depending on where you're from, I think.
Well, I guess alcohol culture also is so different in all of those places. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wrote it down as being like cultural alcoholism. Yeah. That'd be fair to say.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, but here's the thing about it. It's like, I think that sort of behaviour, everything in the movie happens in a college bar in mm-hmm. America, or in a pub, in even a bar in, you know, London. It's about that point when everyone's had a little too much to drink and everything's about to spiral out of control. And how do we stop it from ever spiraling? Like, how do we say no at that point and not have to accept what's coming next, essentially?
Yeah, it's terrifying. It's a weird comparison, but I almost felt the way about this as I did as Oppenheimer, where I kind of realized leaving it that there's been this fear that I'd live with my entire life, like nuclear annihilation or men.
Yeah.
And like I had to like confront that.
Yeah.
Was there ever a kind of an idea that you would insert a kind of heroic man into this at all, rather than...
No, but trust me, there were actors that wanted to play the part and save the women in the end. Like, we got that from, like, people were interested in playing the role but said, I'd love them to come back and, like, fix the place and figure out the girls. I was like, no, that's so not right. Yeah. What was the question?
Just like, I mean, I think you kind of speak to something that a lot of people live with their entire lives with this film, and it almost, like, shines a light on it in a way that's quite difficult to confront, I guess.
Yeah.
That's not a question. I mean, like, it's very scary at times. Mm. And, like, the film, the setting itself, to me, kind of felt a bit like the Bates Motel. I mean, how did you kind of envisage this pub? Did you build it? Did you find it?
We found the exterior. I wanted a two-story pub. I loved the image of it. And I felt like it's very kind of iconically Australian in that way, but also had this kind of Western sort of thing going on, which was interesting. And so we found one, but it was actually the first one we saw. Everyone's like, how did you find this pub? We're like, we literally just drove out of town and it was there. It's a few hours north of Adelaide. And the challenge was mostly like the budget meant we couldn't afford to keep everyone out there. So we had to build an interior in a set in the city, just because it was no way to... not only could we not afford to keep people out there, we couldn't afford to shut a pub down for 3 weeks anywhere. They would lose too much money in doing that. So we had to kind of create our own set, which was actually worked out quite well. We were worried about, but my production designer, Leah, is really brilliant, and she pulled it off and somehow made it feel lived in and real. And so that was that kind of worked out quite well. And then the space just had, I don't know, you fill that space with men all wearing the same uniform and it gets very scary very quickly. And like, was also COVID-y and everyone was breathing very on each other. It felt very scary just walking through it, I think, in a way. Even though it was safe and we kind of had created a safe environment, it still stick that many people in a room together. And it's a little, there's a lot of, I don't have to work hard to get the tension out of that. You know what I mean? It exists.
But in terms, I mean, when they go out of the pub into the kind of landscape, you've got this outback that's beautiful and vast and terrifying still. Working with the same cinematographer, I believe, Michael Latham.
Yeah.
What did you kind of visually want to capture with those outside scenes?
I mean, the place is so claustrophobic, but this idea that when you walk outside, it's equally terrifying, even though it's so vast, you know, but still the remoteness of it and just the isolation really adds to the tension and the things we're building. So even though I feel like the events inside the pub could happen anywhere in the world, we're adding another layer of terror in presenting it in that kind of setting, I guess. It's also visually really striking, and I had wanted to make an Australian film, and it's great to kind of really take advantage of the landscape when if you're out there, like, you know, go wide, you know.
Not a place I'm in a rush to
visit. Yeah.
Maybe one day I might recover. And finally, I wanted to ask you, one of my bugbears in films is people are so bad at performing being drunk. It's almost like I don't know whether it's because actors don't notice what they're like when they're drunk.
Yeah. We all forget.
But what direction did you give people in terms of, performing just being absolutely wasted?
Someone gave me a good tip, which is a drunk person's always trying to pretend to be sober.
Okay.
So it's like this, you've got to kind of work against it and almost try and pretend you can handle it, but you can't. And so that was a really good trick. I don't know, some of them, I kind of let everyone do their own thing. I'm sure a few of them had a few sips of something before they got into it. That wasn't allowed, but I'm sure it went, you can't really stop it all from going on. But I don't know, I mean, each of them, we cast really well, and Hugo Weaving, who plays probably the drunkest of the lot, was just so phenomenally brilliant that he just did it, and it was just incredible, and watching him do it was wonderful, stumbling everywhere, and then we call cut, and he's just such a gentleman and like so composed, and it was such a wild kind of he's so brilliant. So we were very fortunate, I think. We just cast the right way and got the right kind of people involved, and I think a few of them, I mean, Dan Henschel, who plays Dolly, he took a lot of the kind of the supporting cast out for beers and sort of spoke to them a fair bit, and I think having kind of different people captain each area of the bar meant that it felt quite safe and quite controlled, and like everyone was on the same team essentially and understood what we were doing. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. That's good to know that Hugo Weaving is lovely. I was about to kind of throw all the men out with the bathwater.
No, they're all lovely, by the way. They're all lovely, I have to say. We got a good
bunch. Don't believe you.
Yeah, exactly. No, we had a good time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks.
So, Bea, I came into this like super hype. I love The Assistant so much. Were you a fan of Kitty Green's?
Yeah, The Assistant was amazing, and I think this is like such a natural continuation of her sort of work and style. And I mean, she does a great job of showing sort of the reality of life as a young woman today in sort of horrific ways that are painful to watch often. I really liked this. Yeah. I mean, I used to work at pubs and stuff, and as a Canadian in the UK, that was like a bit of a culture shock as well. Just like the whole, I know it's very different probably to Australia, but like pub culture here is quite different to what Canadians working in like restaurants or bars might experience, I think, depending on where you work, obviously. But it's like working in hospitality as a young woman, especially when there's a bar with stools with regulars on them who come and sit there every day, and like you're kind of trapped there in that situation. And while usually you are like physically safe, these girls, well, may not be ultimately. It can feel, and I think this film does a really good job of capturing that feeling of feeling like you're kind of trapped in this really uncomfortable position, and you don't really have the tools to stop it.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I worked in hospitality for like a really long time, and that sort of pressure to perform, I suppose, being so
kind and sweet at all times and having zero boundaries and, you know, oh, God. Again, wouldn't go back to my 20s or my late teens for all the money in the world. But Ella, for you, I mean, like, this is, I mean, not only was I excited that it's Kitty Green, but also love a 90-minute runtime. Was that, like, how do you think it did with kind of like delivering a story within like a very taut time frame?
I love this film. I actually forgot it was 90 minutes because, like, until you said it, because it feels much longer to me. And I say that as a compliment. I don't know. I think it fits so much in. It's really, I feel like the assistant was amazing. It was very, very subtle, very subdued. I feel like I'm repeating the same words for every film, but it's true. And it was like a lot of like simmering tension. And to me, the Royal Hotel feels like Kitty is saying, okay, well, all right, I earned your respect with that. Now I'm going to have some fun, which feels strange to say, because I will say that many people I spoke to who have seen the film, and I truly hate to generalize, but I am literally like going off conversations I've had. Every man I've spoken to who has seen this film was like, oh my God, that was so stressful. Or I felt like a horror film. I couldn't watch it. And like, I got to the end of the film and I was like, that was quite fun. There is a lot of tension in it. And, you know, there is, the threat of violence is always there. But I do think that it's very entertaining. Like, it goes very quickly. The 90 minutes go very quickly, but it also packs so much in, and there's so much personality, and there's so much drama, but also in a fun way, that I think it's so well executed, and just like it felt really, really tight to me and very well, like there's no fat on it. I think earns its runtime. I kind of want to watch it as a TV show. Like, I want to see different episodes of the people.
Well, you know, it's also a documentary, right?
Yeah. So I haven't seen the documentary, which I would like to. But I feel like, you know, those, like that kind of framework where it is, you know, a sort of one location, strange things happen in this place, people come and go and stuff. You know, I think that is well poised to kind of have more stories within it. I mean, that won't happen. But anyway, all that to say, it's good. It's entertaining. I could watch more of it.
Yeah, I found myself really believing, even though they're such different people, in this like bond between Hannah and Liv. Like, even though they're kind of on quite divergent paths, I sort of really bought them as best friends who would do anything for one another.
I think also, like, it's so fun because obviously Julia Garner was the main actor in The Assistant. And I think it's always cool when you do kind of see like a relationship like that developing between the director and their star, you know, like Emma Seligman and Rachel Senna and Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro. But, you know, I think, like, Julia Garner and Kitty Green have a really good, like, very interesting rapport. And yeah, like, Jessica Henwick, who plays Liv, is, like, very, very different. And, again, she brings a lot of that, like, a lot of the energy and, again, some of that fun, even if it's misplaced and misguided, that the assistant didn't have and shouldn't have had. But I think that really suits this kind of story to have those different personalities. I know we have to move on, but I want to shout out to people in this film who are not women. So sorry.
Boo.
I'm so sorry. No, but you know what? I do also think that, like, and we'll come on to this with How to Have Sex, I do think that any good, very good film about gender dynamics and like the complexities and difficulties of that has to have well-drawn male characters as well. Like, you can't shut men out of it if you want to say something interesting about them, I think.
I'm joking. They are wonderful.
Yeah. But for this film, like, for example, yeah, in The Assistant, you know, Matthew McFadden plays this horrible HR person and he's incredible. But in this film, the two actors I want to shout out are Herbert Nordrum, who plays Eivind in The Worst Person in the World. And I asked Kitty Green about this and she was like, oh yeah, like I'd 100% just seen that and like rewrote the character for him. It was written as a German backpacker. And then she realized like that he might be free and like retooled it around him. It's very funny. I think it's great value. Happy to see him. And then Toby Wallace, of Baby Teeth fame, and also Pistol on Disney Plus. Baby Teeth fame. I love him so much. Just whenever he pops up, he just brings like such a strange energy. Like, he's very slippery, and I think, you know, he's nice until he's not, but he's very like he's not just a nice guy and he's not just a very bad guy. And he has such amazing chemistry with Judah Garner. I want him to be in everything and I'm glad he's in this.
Yeah, it is always interesting kind of when people are cast a bit against type in that way. I mean, I suppose it's what like Emerald Fennell tried to do with Promising Young Woman, of kind of like, actually it's more interesting if you cast charming people in those roles. But yeah, I mean, for you, Meg, the thing that made me nervous slightly watching this is like, I was worried it was going to do something in its final act, which it sort of hints is possible, and it doesn't. And I was very relieved. So I think on my second watch, I actually enjoyed it a lot more. But like, I mean, how did you kind of feel in its final moments? I've seen criticism of it saying that like it kind of falls apart in its final act, but its final act was my favorite.
Yeah, I don't think it falls apart. I think that's like just a not true. I don't think it falls apart at all. I think it is. I'm glad it doesn't go all the way, as you said. It hints at something like really awful that could happen and pulls it back, and then has this sort of wonderful last image that encapsulates like both the fun and the horror that it's been building throughout. And I really like that. Like it keeps this kind of, as Ella said, like sense of fun and like play to it. It doesn't, you know, it's not like super serious and solemn, but it's like kind of badass.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's not her most subtle work, but I think it's all the better for it. And I'm with you. I love that final shot.
Just so sick. Kind of,
yeah.
It's so fun. I will say as well, like, you know, I interviewed Kitty for Letterboxd and I sort of raised all these things saying that, you know, the ending's been divisive. And she was like, I'm baffled. And I agree in the sense that I'm like, well, she was saying, people who saying they wanted it to go further are basically implying that there needs to be a rape for the film to be good. And I was like, I'm glad you said it because, but it's true. And it is like, it is absolutely crazy that, you know, and it is like decades of cinema, which condition us to be like, oh, so this is when the film gets good, which is absolutely deranged. And then, you know, and
this
then,
is when she gets punished.
Honestly. And then on the flip side as well, like the fact that she does go very far with the ending and it is quite a big swing. She'd also said that she was like, well, I couldn't just have them walk away and just be like, oh, well, this happens, which is so cool, I think, as well, because I don't know. I feel like the Royal Hotel is showing that, like, yes, these things do happen. It doesn't need to go all the way for things to be bad, but also it does need to go all the way for things, like, for there to be justice. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, on one end, women don't need to suffer, but also women have a right for revenge as well. I don't know. I think it's great. I love the ending. I love this film.
Yes. Only thing that would have made it even better for me if they had somehow teamed up with Tommy, the only nice man in Australia, who is in one scene and he was delightful. Yeah, there's just always a sequel in there, seeing where he gets his revenge for other reasons, which I hinted at. But Meg, do you want to go first with your scores in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I might go 4-3-4 for this one. I was really excited to see it after seeing The Assistant and hearing such cool things about it. I think during it, I was like a bit stressed. I like don't deal well with scary hallways and people being chased, so but the more I think about it now, the more I'm enjoying it in hindsight.
Ella, what about you?
I might go a bit crazy and go 4-5-4.
Kitty Green is so charming, isn't she?
She's just so cool. It's definitely a 4 in retrospect. Like, you know, I appreciate there are certain things that aren't perfect, but I do just think the first time I saw it, that ending, it's so cool. And like, and I do think there's not a bad performance in the film. The tension builds really well. Yeah, could have watched another hour of it. Call me crazy. 4-5-4.
And gorgeous. Because I think as much as I love The Assistant, like, I mean, actually that's sterile and, you know, what do you call those, you know, office lighting, and everybody looks a kind of bit pallid and sad. And so like, it's really nice to kind of see her doing things with like landscapes.
That being said, I will not be visiting the Australian Outback anytime soon. Yes, 4s across the board for me as well. Sorry, I'm being very boring with my scores, but like, what can I say?
It's a good week.
Good week. Next up, it's How to Have Sex. Three British girls go on a rite of passage holiday, drinking, clubbing, and hooking up in Malia on the Greek island of Crete of what should be the best summer of their lives. So, I mean, like, that, I feel like the rite of passage is that so many of us has if you go on, like, a very disappointing holiday with your friends just after your GCSEs. I mean, like, was this something that you related to?
Yes, Tenerife 2014. Next question. Yes, like, you know, note for note, beat by beat, exactly the same holiday, which is eerie. Like, it's the kind of film... I will say I wasn't, like... super, super hyped to watch this. I saw it in Cannes, so like there weren't kind of any reactions or anything first. And I wasn't super hyped to watch it just because, I'll be honest, I think the title put me off a little bit because I thought, oh, this is going to be like, this is going to be a comedy. This is just going to be a kooky, like, watch as a teenage girl figures out, doop, 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 you know, this kind of thing. And it's very much like not that. But it just, it's the kind of film that when I was watching it, I was like, oh, I didn't realize that this experience was like worthy of a film until I saw it on film. And then you're like, oh, it just, I don't know, like it really rattled me. And it is also very entertaining in, you know, in its parts and in its ways. Another one that really kind of juggles tones very, very precisely, I think. I don't know how it would play if, like, if you have no skin in the game, like if you haven't been on a holiday like this, if your friends haven't been on a holiday like this, or if you don't really know what this kind of holiday is, because I think, you know, I've had conversations with some of my friends who are critics in the US and stuff, and they just don't really get it. And you know, I think part of that might be obviously disagreeing with Molly Manning Walker's sensibilities and sensitivities as a filmmaker, which I fully appreciate. But I do think also half of the joy of it for me was recognizing all of this stuff that, you know, that I've lived through, which I think might be considered cheating in some way. Like, I think if you deeply identify with the film, obviously it's going to make you... It helps you to like it more without sort of taking a bit of a step back and looking at like how it's made and the wider implications and stuff. I do also think it's expertly made, but I think the sort of specificity of the experience is both one of the strongest parts of it and something that I'm like a little bit wary of how it will play when it goes much wider, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, that's really interesting. I mean, there do seem to be some sort of universal themes that kind of like you can almost see running through this entire this entire week. But yeah, there is, I think this, the film, as much as I did like it, does have that reliance on nostalgia in the way that I felt that After Sun, another sort of Cannes film about a holiday that was very kind of like British, like managed to break free a little bit more of like you actually having to get like the references to like what a resort in Turkey would be like.
Yeah, like After Sun, I do think that everything with After Sun is fascinating because I do feel for every British film made by a woman coming after Sun, because the comparisons are inevitable, even though like the films are so different. Like I haven't seen anything like After Sun since, and I don't want to. But inevitably when you're like, a British woman has made a film and it's on a holiday, like it's very easy to sort of be like, aha, you liked After Sun. But you know, even if people didn't like After Sun, I think I've seen far fewer pieces of writing, like good and bad, about, like, obviously there was a lot of personal writing and responses to After Sun, but I think there's more so for How to Have Sex because of the very, very, like the very specifics of it, if that makes sense. Because with After Sun, it's like, you know, parenting, grief, memory, all of these things which are expertly dealt with that allow you to sort of come to it in different places, I think. I love How to Have Sex, though, like, let all that be said. But I think it's an interesting one to sort of wrestle with in that way of like how and where it will find people.
Yeah, because I guess you just have like sense of like, oh, because this is like for you. This must be what it's like to be a white man and watching most of films. Like
exactly.
It is an interesting one from my perspective, because obviously I grew up in Canada. I mean, I lived in the UK when I was 11 for a year and kind of like got a sense of like teen culture here, mm-hmm. which struck me as very different. People like age a lot quicker, I found. But as like a woman watching this, I think whether you've been on one of those like rites of passage British teen holidays or not, there are things in it you definitely recognize. And she, Molly Manning Walker, does like such a great job of painting such a vivid picture of this world and making it feel so detailed and real that you, I think you quite quickly like get what the vibe is and mm-hmm. you buy into it. You know, the design of it, the focus on like the games they're playing, and it's quite like reflective, sort of meditative in a way. Like you're just sitting with them, watching them do their thing on this holiday, and it feels, you know, their relationships feel super genuine and real. And yeah, I think you kind of get the vibe of the holiday, whether you've been on one or not. Although I can imagine if you have been there, it's a lot, probably a lot harder to watch, although it was deeply hard for me to watch as well.
But it's quite entertaining. It's like, I know I keep saying this. It's like, I'm not enjoying women suffering in any form, but it's entertaining, I think, in the sense of all of the actors. I think it's more in their mannerisms and sort of the way that they talk, and also just like how loud they are. I think that's sort of the specificity for me that I was like, oh, I know she can seem annoying. I know, but also like, I feel like I know her, so she's allowed. Yeah, Mia McKenna-Bruce, who plays Tara, the main character, is absolutely sensational. I think she's very loud until she's not. She is very bubbly, very funny, but I think she also plays the difficult moments amazingly, like so heartbreaking. But I think also like her friends around her as well, there is that kind of like ride or die solidarity among the friends, but also the very performative, this is the best summer of our lives and aren't we all having so much fun? And like, that's annoying to be around. It's really annoying. So I think that's something that, you know, it has to be that way in order to feel true. And I think for the fluctuations in emotions to hit, but like it can be grating as well. I would argue more from the girls than the boys because I clearly hate women. But the boys are very complex and like strange in this. And again, good boys in this film about women. But Molly Manning Walker has said this in a number of Q&As that like one of the main goals with this film was to not shut men out because like they want boys to see this, like young boys to see what these boys do and be like, oh shit, like that thing I thought was a laugh and was fun, it, you know, really isn't. And it's, I don't know, just everyone involved in this film does that so, it's so subtle and, but just like really powerful without hitting you on the head whatsoever. And I think it's so hard to do that without either feeling like really gross and horrible and sort of manipulative and just like nasty to watch as a woman, while still hammering home how bad this behavior is, you know, while still protecting audiences, I think.
Yeah, the way they capture like the whole journey as like a sort of male bystander to these sort of like sexist microaggressions or whatever you want to call them is like so, so well done, because you see every stage and like the thought process plays out so clearly on the screen. And it's important, as you say, to show what men are going through and not like judge them and like be preachy about it, but to like open up a discussion about it and about why it happens, about why it's like so ingrained in the culture that we have here. And yeah, she does a great job. There's that one scene where like Tara and Badger are sitting just in silence for like minutes on end, and it's so powerful. Like she could have like had a speech, or like he could have had a speech, but just watching them like sit there and grapple with not really knowing what to say, and I think it's so well done.
Also, she could have burst into tears and she doesn't, and like you know, you can still tell how affected she is and how bad she feels. But again, it's just like one of like many, many things in this film where it's like you fully understand how she's feeling, but the film never casts any judgments on her whatsoever, which I think is amazing. And it's so hard to do that while still pointing very clearly at like, this person is bad, this thing that happened is bad, but she is still, like she's still who she is. She doesn't suddenly get given a label or lose her personality because one thing or another happens to her, which I think a lot of filmmakers seem to find very hard. There are more and more filmmakers that I think, you know, in the last 5-10 years are kind of grappling with that really, really well. But as a rule, it's quite a complex thing to not make a woman seem like a victim.
Yeah, I think a lot of that really does come down, like you mentioned, Mia McKenna Bruce, who's just phenomenal. And I've always feel like I'm some old-timey Hollywood executive when I say stuff, but like, that kid's a star.
She is, yeah.
She's got moxie.
Meg, do you want to go first with your scores on how to have sex in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I think I'll go 3-4-4 for this one. I was excited to see it after reading about like the reactions at Cannes and stuff, but I didn't anticipate it to be quite as, I thought it would be like a more sort of arduous watch than it was, maybe a bit more like, yeah, preachy or like a bit of a slog, but it wasn't that at all. And I was, yeah, I was really impressed with it.
Ella, what about you?
So I'm going to go rogue with this one again, and I'm going to go 3-5-4 because 3, because I didn't know anything about Molly Manning Walker and the title put me off a little bit. 5, well, 5 came from my rewatch. I've seen it twice, and the first time I watched it was on a screener and it was good. But then I saw it in the cinema at TIFF. And it, like, if anyone, the film will eventually be on movie, but if you have the chance to see it in cinemas, I would highly recommend, because the sound design and the score is incredible. You know, I mean, the score is done by James Jacob, who is a DJ and at the same time is training to be a counsellor. So, you know, great at music and understands people. So all of these things. But yeah, and I think also because of like the lights and the holiday and all of it. I mean, Molly is also a cinematographer, as well as, she didn't do this film, but she did Scrapper and has just such an amazing visual eye. So anyway, so if you can see it in a cinema, that really bumped up to a 5, to be honest, for me. But then in retrospect, I will come down to a 4 because I don't know why. I think, yeah, it's like, it's really good. It is really good. But to be honest, it's the kind of thing as well that because it's her debut, like I kind of want the sort of Kitty Greenification of Molly Manning Walker, in the sense that her first feature is amazing. I want her second one to like change my life. Yeah,
that's it's quite a lot to ask, but
sorry, Molly.
But yeah, I think, yeah, I was like, I did a 2 coming in, even with like the can of it all. For some reason, I thought this was going to be like girl version of the Inbetweeners movie.
Yeah.
In some ways it is. But I was not kind of expecting it to kind of devastate me and like make me feel kind of like weirdly protective over my younger self. Though having said that, Ella, I was not as cool as you and didn't go on a big party holiday.
It was not cool. There was like 4 of us.
I went to Amsterdam, but we rented bikes and mostly went to museums.
Cute. I'm doing that in January for the first time ever. So you're ahead of the game.
So probably at like a 2-4, definitely enjoyment. And then it's tricky because it's like the other films of the week. And like, do I want to give it the exact same as Anatomy of a Fall, which, you know, really moved me and I loved Royal Hotel. So I feel like I'm going to go like 3.999 because I kind of can't give them quite the same ranking. And yeah, it's my podcast. I can do what I want. Right. Before we get going, you guys have one last thing to recommend to listeners. Ella, what is your non-movie recommendation?
I'm really sorry about this, but I took a week off work last week, and my rule now when I take time off work, basically the only thing that I watch during that time is old seasons of Taskmaster, because it's very entertaining but it's very silly and I don't think it counts as TV or art in any way. So last week I watched series 9, which has Ed Gamble in it, and I saw his podcast Off Menu with James Acaster. They did a live show in London a few weeks ago and I went to that. And so I was like, huh, I'd seen the Taskmaster season that James is in, but I hadn't seen Ed's one. So big recommendation from me. Very, very funny.
Yeah. I mean, there is a very dark world out there at the moment. And like, escapism is valuable. Just something being fun and funny, like treasure it. Please, listeners, go and watch Taskmaster. Meg, what about you? What is your non-movie recommendation?
I also went for like something that brought me a lot of joy recently. I am like completely, deeply obsessed with the 3rd season of Only Murders in the Building. Mm. I feel like it's like changed my life. it's like got this whole like Broadway homage thing going on, and like it really spoke to like my teen musical theater nerd that lives inside me. And I was like, oh my God, that song's so inspired by like the Jekyll and Hyde musical. And I felt like seen, and Meryl Streep is in it, and I just love it so much.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's the best season by far.
I agree.
And, you know, and not just because of Meryl. I think Paul Rudd? Who's
Paul
in
Rudd.
It?
Paul Rudd.
Yes.
What a man. What a man.
Yeah, another person tamping down on their natural charisma to kind of play a problematic male. But yeah, no, that's a really good one. So I might rewatch that, actually. Yeah, we'll see. Oh, wait, no, I have work to do. Never mind. Well, if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. We'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about Emerald Fennell's Saltburn, Todd Haynes' May December, and revisiting The Go-Between for Film Club. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Ella Kemp and Meg Walters. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.